Welcome, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us, and a special thank you to TAC, SOI, Stern Student Council, and YSU for their sponsorship. It's really encouraging to see that our student body understands and appreciates the importance of events like this. A very special thank you to our panelists, Rabbi Jeremy Weider, Rosh Hashiva Reitz, Rabbi Shmuel Meibrook, a relationship coach and founder of The Relationship Couple, and Dr. Risa Koren, a psychiatrist from the Hawaii Counseling Center, all experts in their respective fields. We appreciate you coming out to provide us with guidance on such important and relevant issues. Dating is a very tricky thing in general, and in order to create a strong connection with your partner, you begin to reveal things about yourself that can be very personal and intimate. This in itself is challenging for some, and can become especially challenging when dealing with a mental illness. How do you navigate a potentially awkward or uncomfortable situation, both as a partner with a mental illness and as the one dating someone with a mental illness? So regarding this issue, halakha is one of, you know, the many concerns that come up. And for that, we turn to Rabbi Weider. Rabbi Weider is an esteemed Rosh Hashiva, a prolific scholar, and a professor of Bible at Yeshiva College. Rabbi Weider will be addressing the halakhic concerns surrounding the divulgence of mental illness in dating relationships. Are you obligated to tell your partner about your mental illness? If so, when? At what point is withholding this information considered gneva stas, if at all? Having halakhic guidance is so important when dealing with this already overwhelming issue. So without further ado, Rabbi Weider.
Thank you. Dealing with these issues, I think, probably can be broken down into three areas. The first one would be sort of the ethical and halakhic questions. The second would be what I'll call the clinical questions, and the third would be sort of advice in terms of how you communicate, what you communicate. I certainly have no expertise in the latter two categories, so I'm not going to address them. And what I'm going to try to do first is to lay out very briefly some of the potential prohibitions slash issues that may arise in dealing with these issues, and then I will respond to specifically four questions that I was asked to address, applying some of those principles and adding certain things. The Rambam writes in the Hilchos Mechira that also the Rambam says b'nei Adam b'mekach v'memkar o ligno v'sdatim. You're not allowed to cheat someone in commerce or to deceive them, even when it's not for financial gain. And this applies to Jews and non-Jews equally. He says hayeyodeh sheyesh b'memkar o mum. If you know that in your sale there is a defect or a blemish, so yodio v'alokech. You have to let the buyer know that in fact there is this deception. It may seem somewhat unromantic in the context of dating and marriage to talk about it in a transactional sense, but both from a legal perspective and from a historical perspective, in fact, from a real perspective in life, that is a central component to marriage. Marriage, in some sense, is, even though it may sound unromantic, it's a contract between two parties, each party brings certain things into the relationship, into the marriage, and therefore, aside from all the wonderful things that are not quantifiable and can't be put down on paper in a legal code, it is certainly governed by legal principles that govern what we might call the area of kinyanim, transactions of acquisitions. There are a number of prohibitions, theoretically, that could be relevant in various aspects of marriage, and particularly marriage contracted under false pretenses or when something wasn't revealed. One possibility is the question of geneva, straight-out theft. It's not entirely clear that one can talk about genevas mamon in the technical sense when you're talking about marrying someone. There is no monetary acquisition, and I don't wish to talk about it, despite the fact that one of the forms of kiddushin is kesef. That has nothing to do with monetary acquisition. A second consideration, which is probably not so relevant here, but I was asked about this, was the prohibition of genevas das. Genevas das is a narrower prohibition which applies to acquiring something under false pretenses, but it's not goods or objects, but rather it's the acquisition of social goodwill under false pretenses. I invite you for a meal that I don't want you to come to, and I know you can come and won't come, but I do so to ingratiate myself with you because that social capital has value down the line somehow and somewhere. I'm not sure that genevas das typically comes up in these situations because it's really worse than genevas das. It's more than just deceiving someone for social capital. It's for something much more valuable. There is also a prohibition of onas mamon, of cheating in a monetary sense, which certainly applies in a case where I sell you something but I misrepresent the price. It's not as clear whether or not, technically speaking, onas mamon applies in situations where I don't deceive you on a price per se, but I actually don't deliver the goods that were promised. But it might very well fall under that category of the lo sonu ishes amiso, which refers to cheating, some certain type of cheating in commerce. Two other prohibitions that are almost definitely relevant in this context, relevant in many ways, not only in situations of dealing with mental illness. The first one is onas dvarim. Onas, the Torah says twice, lo sonu ishes amiso. Chazal understand that one refers to cheating in terms of deceiving someone on the price and the value of an object, and the other refers to the inflicting of emotional pain upon another person in an unjustified or unnecessary manner. Onas dvarim can come up in many different contexts, certainly not limited to the field of dating and marriage, but certainly if one engages in dishonest behavior in a relationship, which inevitably, when discovered, is going to lead to the inflicting of emotional pain on another person, that is certainly a very clear violation of onas dvarim. And finally, and perhaps a very interesting one, is the prohibition of lifnei iver lo siken mechshol. Lifnei iver, for most of us who encounter in halacha contexts, it's funny here, the literal reading of scripture, which actually is part of the halacha as well, is often ignored. And we normally think of it in the world of the Beis Medrash, is that if I enable somebody else to sin, that's a classic question of lifnei iver, putting a stumbling block in front of a blind person. But in fact, lifnei iver also refers to literally putting a stumbling block in front of a blind person, not in the halachic sense, but in the physical sense. And it also refers in the realm, not of the spiritual, but of the physical and material, of giving somebody bad advice. Now, one of the examples that Rashi cites from the Toras Konim is if I give someone bad advice, they'll sell the field because I really want to buy it. I sort of, you know, I give them bad counsel. That's a violation of lifnei iver lo siken mechshol. And here I think one very important point has to be made because it's very much relevant in this context. When I was discussing the question I was first posed with a few months ago with my wife, we were having a debate about a certain issue in terms of when do you disclose, which is probably the most complicated issue in the entire thing. I won't speak from a dating and clinical perspective. I'm pretty sure that from a dating perspective, it's one of the most difficult decisions to make. When do you tell? But also from a halachic ethical perspective, it's also very daunting. And it was in this conversation that my wife sort of illuminated my thinking about one particular issue involved. One of the reasons why you don't, on the first date, pull out your list of defects, you know, and say, these are my things, is because you figure you're not going to even get past the first minute of the date that way. And certainly you don't tell them when you call them off the phone, by the way, you know, I have the following six diseases, you know, and I've been, you know, institutionalized for whatever, this and that, the other thing, because you know that you're not going to go out on the first date. So the question is, why don't you tell them that? Because you want to go out on the first date. But you're going to have to tell them anyway, eventually. So why don't you tell them initially? And my thinking is, you don't tell them initially because you want them to see a full picture of you, right? You're not just a disease or an ailment or something that afflicts you. You're an entire person, and probably there's not a single person standing or sitting in this room who doesn't have some defect once you start digging down. Some skeleton, I don't mean in the sense of scandal, but in their closet, there's some issue that they deal with, you know, that they're not very good at in life. And so you want people to see the entire picture first. But there's a downside to that, because what you're also doing is you're sort of enticing them to fall in love with you, at least in the modern context in which most of us date. And then what that really does is it makes it much harder for them to look at the particular issue that you may have, which may be a really serious issue, and then to make a good decision. And it is in a form of lifnei iver lo siken mechshol, meaning if I have sort of created a relationship with someone, it's gone on for a long time, and we're really, really bonded, and then I sort of tell them about this, they're likely, if it's a bad choice for them to marry me because it really is a thing that you maybe don't want to marry someone, they're in effect blinded by everything, all the circumstances that have been created. And I want to stress that lifnei iver is not necessarily mitigated just because a person actually knows that they're not actually being deceived. Some of you probably know that when it comes to the prohibition of helping somebody sin, being enabling them to do the particular thing, so it doesn't make a difference whether or not the person is going to do it by mistake or doing it on purpose. Even if the person knows what they're doing is wrong, you are not allowed to provide assistance. I always wondered, why is that so? Why is that lifnei iver lo siken mechshol? They're not blind. They know exactly what they're doing. They know it's prohibited. So the Rambam, in a remarkably insightful comment, and you might recognize this from a different Rambam, the Rambam says, because when a person is enticed to sin, their taiva, their yetzer hara, their desire, their passion overwhelms them, and so in effect, it's like they're blind. They are blinded. We might say they are blinded by desire. So even when a person has all of the information in front of them, if you have created an emotional situation where it's hard for them to make the correct or the intelligent decision, you have in effect violated Lifnei Iver Lo Sitein Meshal. You have first blinded them, and now they're in a position where it's hard for them to make an intelligent and thoughtful and rational decision. Now, I'm not saying that means that you're supposed to call them up and give them a list of issues before the first date, but I'm just pointing out that that actually is one of the most complicated applications of how do you decide the balance between wanting to get a real look at you as a whole person, on the other hand, not going so far as to blind them and make it impossible for them or very difficult for them to make a thoughtful and intelligent and rational decision. So let me now briefly, I don't want to spend so much time, but let me address the questions from more halachic, specific questions with the application. The question number one I was asked is as follows. There's an obligation to tell your partner that you have a mental illness. If so, does severity play a role for there to be an obligation of telling your partner? Can you play things down? Must you tell your partner that you are taking medications? How much needs to be disclosed and when? And what constitutes Gneivas Daas? Now, the formulation of this question is presented from the perspective of the person who has the information, who has to deal with the particular issues that they're dealing with, and what do they have to disclose. But I think when you think about this issue, you have to just put the shoe on the other foot. Put yourself in the shoes of the other person, and how do they feel about these issues not being disclosed? And I present that from two vantage points. Number one, and here I'll venture into the relationship question, concealing something is generally a very, very bad idea. Because ultimately, unless it's the kind of thing that no longer exists and it's never going to be a problem, because it's going to come out. And what happens when the person that you've been dating for a year, or you're engaged to, or you're married to, all of a sudden you find out that they have this illness that they've known for a long time, you can almost be sure that it's going to destroy the relationship. Marriage, dating and marriage is not a situation of, I have to grab the person, I have to get them, and once I got them, I got them. It's not the way it works. The real work in marriage begins after you get married, and if you basically established a false foundation, you basically probably destroyed the relationship from the start. The second issue is v'ahavta l'recha kamocha, right? You would expect someone else to disclose those things to you, so why do you think you don't have to disclose it to them? And so in terms of most of these questions, do you have to tell the person your mental illness? Of course. Does severity play a role? Well, the question is the following. You know, if I, you know, have a tic where I occasionally can scratch my cheek, you know, once every 2 days, probably not. But anything that's of any significance, the answer is, of course you have to tell them. And the truth is, who's really entitled to decide? The answer is the other person. If you tell them about a particular issue they have, it's up to them to decide, well, who cares? Big deal. Or maybe this is something that I need to think about, but it's not for you to conceal. So I'm not suggesting that you need to, you need to have hypnosis to recall everything you've experienced in your life and divulge that to the person. Some things are best left buried for yourself and everyone. But anything that, if you have to think about maybe I should divulge it to them, the answer is probably you should, and it's for them. It's up to them. It's their right ethically, halachically, to make the decision for themselves whether or not that's something, you know, they wish to deal with. Can you play things down? Well, again, are you allowed to be deceptive? It depends. If it's, you know, not everything is a big deal, but then that's not playing it down. I think your responsibility is to present things in an honest fashion. It's up to the other party then to go and take that information and then, in effect, do research, and whatever research means, in order to make an intelligent decision. Do you have to tell them you're taking medication? I presume it depends, but in most cases, medication is the indication of some type of real condition. It needed medication. I don't assume that if you have to take ibuprofen on a somewhat regular basis, I'm not sure that that requires disclosure. But if you're talking about, you know, psychotropic drugs or anything of any serious nature, of course it has to be revealed. The only difficult question is not how much needs to be disclosed, but when it needs to be disclosed. And here I would say one thing, but this doesn't really answer the question. If you work in a system of shadchanus, of course you have to disclose everything to the shadchan. That's the way the system works, right? The shadchan's job is to have, call it resumes. I find the notion offensive, but that's what it is. And if you go through that system, the answer is you have to tell the shadchan everything, you know, that's relevant. There is a concern about privacy, but if you can't trust the shadchan for privacy, you need to find a different shadchan. But it does require really full disclosure. When you're talking about the system that most of you will probably experience, again, I assume most of you, you meet someone, your friend set someone up, so that's where it becomes much more complicated. I don't think there's an obligation to disclose everything at the start, unless it's absolutely clear to you that the person would say no. Then you're wasting their time or you're entrapping them. But in most cases, I think that you can start to date such a person. But once the relationship becomes serious, then I think it's time to disclose things. From a technical, clear legal perspective, the absolute line is when you get married, because that obviously would constitute a mekach toz. But I think that even long before that, you have to deal with the issues of onas devarim, at least onas devarim, the inflicting of emotional pain. If you don't tell someone before you get engaged, you know, engagement, breaking an engagement is something that requires a good degree of fortitude. It shouldn't, but it often people have this sense of shame, and that certainly violates onas devarim in an awful way, and also being malbin p'nei chaver b'rabim, basically causing someone public humiliation. I think even earlier, I think once the relationship gets serious, I think that's the time that you really need to engage in full disclosure. Question number two was, if someone asks you point blank about you or your friend's mental illness, that is, shadchan or friendly inquiring about another friend, you have to answer honestly. Can you lie if you're afraid that you may be turned down simply because you have mental illness? The answer is, if you're going to answer the question, as opposed to saying, I'm not interested, yes, you have to answer the question honestly. To lie because you're afraid you'll be turned down, well, that's obviously being engaged in deception. If you're not talking about a situation of tachanis, you're not obligated to disclose. We generally don't like the practice of lying, but technically speaking, lying is only prohibited in a halacha when it's to gain either money or something else that you're not actually entitled to. If someone asks you about something that's fundamentally private, there is no technical prohibition of lying. It's not something we encourage. There's a wonderful story the Gemara has in Yevamos about Rav Chia, Rav's son. Rav's wife was wonderful, but, well, she did a lot of good things for Rav, but she was very difficult to live with. He'd ask her to make, you know, rice for dinner, she'd make pasta, and ask for pasta, she'd make rice. Rav put up with it, he accepted it, and then as he got older, as Rav Chia got older, all of a sudden his wife started asking what he, you know, Rav Chia would come to him and say, tell your mother I want rice, and all of a sudden his wife started making the food that he asked for, and he said to Rav Chia, he said, your mother's gotten much better. Rav Chia said, no, you tell me you want rice, I go and tell her you ask for pasta. You tell me you want pasta, and you go ask for rice. So Rav laughs, he said, the son is much smarter than the father, but he said, don't do that. I don't want you to teach yourself even to lie. Even though it wasn't prohibited, it was for the purpose of creating shalom. So we are concerned about that. But I think when you need to conceal something that you're entitled to keep private, you don't have to tell the truth. But if you're talking about a shadchan, or someone who wants to set you up and needs the information, it's no longer permissible to lie. That's lying in order to get something that you're not entitled to. And that is prohibited. Question three was, if your partner discloses their mental illness to you and then asks you not to tell anyone, but you need advice from other people or want to tell your parents, can you break that promise? So fundamentally speaking, we have a principle, Sheiris Yisrael Yasu Avla, that when you make a commitment, you're not allowed to renege on the commitment. It doesn't matter whether it's legally binding or enforceable in a court. But in this particular case, you have a material interest. There are probably ways of dealing with it without having to invade a person's privacy. You can ask a third party who has no idea who you're dating, you know, and say, what do you think about this particular circumstance? Or you can choose, if you really can't get a good answer to a life-altering decision, you may decide not to see that person. I think you need to respect their privacy and not divulging to people who are going to know who it is. But often there are ways of getting around that where you can meet both your needs and preserve their needs for privacy. And finally, the last question, to what extent is your responsibility for the safety of your partner? If you know that breaking up with your partner will cause them tremendous agmas nefesh, causing a further regression in the mental health or even self-harm, are you still able to break up with this person knowing that it will put their partner in potential danger? The answer in terms of the responsibility of should you keep in such a relationship is categorically no. Chayecha v'chayecha v'ercha chayecha kodman. Some of you may have watched the Israeli series Shtissel. So if you remember in Shtissel, his first shidduch with Esti, you know, where she was the one who cried. He was going to break it. They want to go out with her, but she started crying. So they said, fine, let's get married. All right. And then they're working out the details with the fathers. And then her father doesn't really want to, his father doesn't want to spend that. And her father says, what can I do? If I don't give her what she wants, she's going to cry. And then he says, yeah, that's why. I was not going to marry her. And then she said that. Of course, that was his way of breaking up the shidduch. But the point is, you don't marry someone because they have issues that you don't want them to feel bad or it's going to be difficult for them. You have to imagine what your life is going to be like. Now, of course, if you feel the person is a danger to themselves, you're obligated, halachically, you know, to make sure that they get the necessary help. But you're not obligated to make your life a living hell because you're afraid what's going to happen when you're going to break up with that person. Of course, you have to make sure, to the best of your ability, to get them the kind of support that they need, but that support is not your marrying them. Marriage is not supposed to be, you know, an act of pity. That's, again, I think, not a very good basis for a relationship. I want to just close with one comment, which is the following. The question of disclosure is not an issue that's relevant halachically only to the people who are dating. There is a prohibition in the Torah of lo samar adam re'echa. You're not allowed to stand by while someone else's life is endangered. And that applies not only to life, it applies to their property and any other harm that's going to befall them in an unjust manner. If you know that somebody has concealed something from a potential spouse, and you have that information, I mean, they're subject to certain rules, but it's a matter of principle, normally speaking, you are obligated to inform the party that is about to be deceived. That would be, to not do so, would be a violation of samar adam re'echa. There are some exceptions to the rule, and I would recommend under those circumstances you go ask a person who is competent in halacha to know whether it fits those exceptions, but your obligation is not only not to deceive your partner, the person you're with, because you can't inflict harm upon them because of something about yourself, you're also obligated, if you know, to make sure that harm doesn't befall someone else. If you saw someone drowning in the river, you have to save them. If you saw their property about to be damaged, if you can, and in most circumstances, you're obligated to step in to protect their property, and this is a circumstance that is no different, because your prohibition of protecting other people is not only you're not deceiving them, but even when they are about to be harmed. Do we want to take questions to this now, or do we want to, how do you want to?
We can take a couple questions.
Okay, you decide when to cut it off. Yes.
So I think two of those principles conflict. Like, let's say you found someone who divulged something, and then someone who is doing, like, in the process of shakhanas, asks you a question about that person, and if you don't divulge it to them, then that's going to have, like, consequences for who they get set up with. But you made a promise to them. How do you
So the truth is, again, the way you would normally deal with this is you would go, again, ask someone, not necessarily a halakhic authority, although that might be useful in this case, someone who might be a little bit wise, to figure out how to avoid both issues. If you ask me, if it boiled down to a case of you promise someone versus the harm, the answer is you're obligated to divulge. Lo samar adam re'echa is a straight-out Torah prohibition. If the nature of a promise in itself is probably the lesser nature, number one, and number two, even if it were more severe nature, it is, for a number of reasons, probably almost certainly overridden by lo samar adam re'echa. Because basically, at that point, they asked you not to divulge, but they're about to commit an avera by not disclosing it. And so probably for multiple reasons, in most cases, there's probably a way of dealing with both, of satisfying both requirements. But if you ask me if we're a head-on conflict, I think lo samar adam re'echa takes precedence. The answer is, again, in a situation where you don't have a third option, the answer is yes. Your silence is taken by them. Is if you know something that's a material issue, then you're not telling that, basically saying, you know, their septum is slightly deviated, you know, their left eye is a millimeter bigger than the right eye, but he's a great guy. I forgot to divulge you that, you know, he's tried to commit suicide 3 times, or whatever it is, right? What do you mean you didn't tell him about that? So the answer is no. You have to divulge the information, because otherwise you're really giving the shot on misinformation.
I'm gonna jump in if it's okay.
Sure.
Okay. So my name is Dr. Corin. I am the psychiatrist at the counseling center, and I thought everything you said was so wonderful. Actually, so wonderfully said. I miss a little bit. In full disclosure, I don't understand all of the Hebrew, so if you guys could keep it fully English for my sake, sometimes it's a little helpful. And so in so many regards, I would say, you know, I feel so fully aligned with many things you said, and then there are ways that I would, like, diverge, of course. Okay, so my background is very different. This is the beginning of my life in this field, and it's, like, literally my first day of, like, starting my career is right there. And so everything I think about is very scientific, and I studied medicine from the bottom up, and when I chose psychiatry, it was after I'd already done everything with the body. So I I'm just giving you my background. So I'd like to sort of speak to the question a little bit, which I think sometimes with religion, I think it feels like the answers, like, are very specifically weighted, and I tend to kind of not think in terms of any one situation being the same for every, you know, not fitting, what doesn't fit every situation, right? So what I would think sometimes is, sometimes I encourage people to come and talk to me about these things at the counseling centers. So, because, like, that sort of situation, if somebody finds themselves caught between two, promises and such that you've promised your best friend, you know, I won't say anything, and then this person comes to you and you're like, oh my God, this is really not a good situation for him or whatever, then I would think that, you know, one thing to do would be to just be as fully honest with your friend as possible, which is, I can't keep that secret for you. And you really have to tell him. Because if I get asked, I will tell him. Like, I can't, like, you have to kind of at certain points be honest with your friends and say, there's only so far I can keep this secret for you. It's not like, and then if they're having trouble being, you know, sort of saying, like, you know, I'm wondering what's getting in the way of telling them. And maybe, you know, maybe we could go speak to Dr. Korn together or go speak to somebody together or her therapist together and sort of find a way to navigate, help her find a way to navigate that situation that you think is, and that she's putting you in a position. She needs to understand that too. Like, you're putting me in a position to lie, and I don't want to lie. And I can't, you know, assure you that I'm not going to be there. So I feel like sometimes there are a lot of ways when you sort of really kind of approach your friends and sort of approach the situation that you can, you know, and usually encouraging them. And I think that brings this sort of point home of talking to people about this dating situation, and a lot of it is how much pain you can cause this person if you withhold your mental illness or your problems you're having. And in a way, what I've found often is that you're also the one who winds up in pain, you know, because if you go too far with this situation and then disclose this information and they end it, you suffer. You know, the longer you go with in any situation in your life with dishonesty, the more you're going to wind up, you know, the pain will come, you'll cause them pain, and then the pain will come back at you. At the end of the day, the whole goal is to sort of find a place to be honest with everybody in some, with some part of that journey.
I just want to add a point. This is it's an essential point. I'm Shmuel Maybrook, and I deal a lot in my practice with relationships. If we look at the situation the way it is, you might run the danger of undermining friendships. Friendships themselves are situations where people can feel that there is some sort of ability to disclose things, and that's not going to disclose to anyone else. It's a completely impermeable membrane. Mm-hmm. I mean, if I have a friend that I talk to about my mental illness, I need to have the confidence that it'll be confidential and won't be disclosed to anyone. So in the situation, like Ray Leader is saying, and Dr. Byrne is saying, if indeed that person would be asked, they might be having a discussion about Lassan or the Mirecha, other issues, but the most important thing then would be for that friend not to be the person that's asked. Meaning, for that person to be, that there is a friendship, there is an absolute. In this room, let's say, closed doors, we can talk about anything, and no one's going to know. And that means that when people want to know about you for a shidduch, I'm not the person you're going to ask. So indeed, if there's a disagreement between the two situations, halachic and hashtafic, as well as pragmatic, it might be something which is, you have to really have a tightrope to walk. Mm-hmm. But ideally, part of the beauty of friendship is to keep that friendship and not make that person the person who's asked. And ideally also, even if the person is asked, often we seem, there's a certain need we feel to get everything off our chest. But often, if you're asked about your friend for a shidduch, instead of saying, this is a nice person, say, well, what do you want to know? What do you know means that it's up to them to ask. Not necessarily up to you to specifically add what you would like to add. And to dovetail on what Rabbi Reuter is saying very beautifully, like the Chofetz Chaim says in Sefer Avos Chesed, his beautiful Sefer, which means love kindness. So the Chofetz Chaim is one of the great sages of the generation. He's known for his halachas of Mishneh Berurah, which is a halachic work, as well as his halachas of Lashon Hara, speaking badly. But he also says for Avos Chesed about loving kindness. He writes in his sefer that indeed, if I know something bad about you, I don't know you at all, but if I knew something bad about you, someone asked me, then it depends. If I know that you're not going to tell at all, I must jump in like what you're saying. If I know that in 3 or 4 days you're going to say it, then it's much more, it's much less of a burden for me to bring it up. If I know there's going to be a situation that you yourself can rely on, which confuses the issue as well. But to me, the important issue is to make sure that friendships can exist absolutely. And that does not necessarily mean there's going to be a divulging of information. It's better if the person just not be involved ultimately.
So is it a contradiction then if they were to say, the subtleties of this, I just want to kind of understand, if they were to say, you know, to this person, you know, I don't really want to discuss this with you. I'm her best friend, you know. But then doesn't that contradict what you're saying, that if you know something about your friend that is somewhat presenting some type of, like, I guess danger is the word you're using, or like situation for him that he will or she will feel betrayed and upset and hurt and, you know, maybe get into some, like, emotional, like, terrain, isn't saying, I don't want to I don't want to discuss this with you. Like, I don't want to discuss her with you. She's
I
my friend.
I would disagree in the following. I think the example you brought initially, again, is a way of resolving the two without mm-hmm. it between. In most cases, you cannot get involved. You can have the friend not be the one to divulge. It's typically more hypothetical. What happens at the end of the day, you're the close friend who knows about this illness, and you discover by chance it hasn't been divulged in the gay marriage week. I think you're ethically absolutely. Obligated to disclose.
Absolutely.
Right. It's rare that it's going to come down to that because right. it's not my responsibility to be, you know, as to be doing what we call the tzitzis check, find out. No, I know this, you know, but if you were to find out, then I think you would be obligated. Again, in most cases, it doesn't come to that.
So even if not asked, you'd be obligated
correct.
To go over and say, there's something you don't know about her.
If you know, they didn't do it. Right? If they didn't do it, hopefully.
Right.
They're, right.
Right.
Just some more questions, I guess, that were submitted. I'm just going to address a couple of them. Some of them are two-part questions. So what are signs that my relationship with my partner is at a stage where I should feel comfortable with my mental illness, / I should disclose that I have a mental illness, and is there any point where it's actually beneficial to delay divulging your mental illness?
That's for the two of you. I have nothing to say.
Okay. So just to ideally, like Ray Wieder alluded to, any relationship is going to be built on MS, on truth. On truth. That is a fundamental idea in Judaism. It was really the one word which really highlighted what Ray Wieder was talking about. And hopefully in every relationship, there is truth. And truth is an interesting thing. Truth seems to be something which is, we think is objective. This is, I'm not sure what color it is, but this is, let's say, wood grain, something like cherry wood, light cherry wood, grain, and that's walnut colored. That's pretty objective, but it's really not true. Life is full of different shades of colors. And if I say, hi, my name is Shmuel, and I'm suffering from social anxiety, then you're going to say, hold on. Not just that you're going to say no second date, but you don't even know who I am. Meaning MS means, truth means, if you see me after 3 dates, 4 dates, might depend on society and specifically what the date means, but if you can see who I am, you see some of the things that I like, some of the things I don't like, some of the ways that I dress, some of the ways that I think, and I have social anxiety, aha, there we have truth. Truth means after 4 dates you have a real picture of what's going on. Like the Maseilas Yesharim writes, the ethical work, which is mostly ethical, writes in his book about ethics, if I want to buy this desk and you tell me, if you're selling it to me, and you say, it's a great desk, but you know there are some kinks, that's a problem. But if you say, hi, you don't really want to buy it because there are some scratches here, that's also not truth. Truthful means, I'll appreciate the desk. They say, it's a nice desk. You say, okay, you like it? I just want to tell you, you know, here there happens to be something, there's a bit of a nick. And here there's something, I see the desk, and now I see that truth means that I can take the entire picture and see it accurately. So a way of looking at the situation of disclosing is not necessarily based upon number of dates, that depends on society. More, quote, yeshiva societies will have less dates, more open societies will have more, and it really depends on the stage of the relationship. But the hallmark of a relationship is MS, is truth. It means you have to know what's really true concerning the relationship. To disclose it earlier is not just being silly. It's not just not the date. That's not MS, that's not truth. So you have to really know what's considered truth. And that really is the idea that my reader said also, if God forbid a person is going to be at the chuppah and they didn't disclose something, so aside from the losana de mariacha, the idea of needing to protect your friends, that is such a violation of MS. Think about what the relationship is like. If this person can't take that person for who they really are, so what relationship is there? And it's as Ray Wieder said, it's so hypothetical because hopefully in a healthy relationship people are going to divulge, not because they need to, but eventually because they want to. The question is, in the beginning of a relationship, then we go back to the MS, even if you're not totally reliant on the other person, there needs to be some way of looking at the situation and seeing the whole picture. That's where it gets a little bit murky, and it's hard to say. Fourth date, fifth date, sixth date, third date. But the concept of keeping it really in context is an essential way of looking at it, to know what real truth is, and what subjective truth is, what objective truth is.
So,
we do with some people have questions from the audience. Is that okay with you?
Yeah.
How do you know if you have a mental illness or if you're just going through a tough time in life?
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, let's say even if you do, or it's very hard to draw a line, but if you do, should you tell yourself that you don't deserve to get married because you do, or should you plow through it and go ahead, even though it may be at the expense of your partner?
How do you know you have a mental illness? It's a very big question. Well, the only way I think of any illness, whether it be mental or and or physical illness, I think of them essentially the same, which is, you know, there's a degree to which sometimes we have things, and then there's a degree to which they interfere in our daily ability to function. Mental illness is particularly a big one on that scope. So a lot of people struggle through periods of time. They get sad. They get anxious. A lot of you guys are in college. It's a very anxiety-provoking experience on many, many levels, socially, academically, where what you're going to do with the rest of your lives, you know. You know, feeling a little less support from home. So it's an anxiety-provoking time. So what my take-home for everybody is, if you feel like any of your sort of emotional state prevents you from either engaging in any of the expected things that you are expected to engage in, which is school, friendships, social life, if you feel like you are not able, like, I can't do these things, or I don't want to do these things, like, I don't feel any interest in doing these things, then I think you at least owe it to yourself to come and speak to someone. And then let someone else decide what's going on. And some things are temporary. I mean, you know, I've been here at the Counseling Center a long time now. I've been doing what I do for a long time. And I've seen many, many students come in where I'm just like, I think this is temporary. I don't think this is going to be a big deal. I think this is going to resolve. And other people, I'm like, I think, you know, we need to help this resolve, which is when I would prescribe medication. In terms of, like, that being an individual's struggle with their own mental illness, and then the notion of kind of being in a relationship, I personally don't think anybody should ever give up on being in a relationship, ever. I think that we are, as human beings, sort of inclined towards relationships, and that we grow and benefit from them, and that everybody's entitled to one. There are lots of different people out there in the world. I actually think I completely feel like you answered the question perfectly. Not in any way different than I really would have answered it myself, in terms of, you know, that there's no one way to do this. There's no one way to disclose things to people. That you have to sort of get a sense of yourself, of knowing yourself, and this notion of when am I connected enough, or when am I in this enough? You know, that there's an honesty built in that. Like, if you're kind of going out and you're like, you know, I like this guy or I like this girl, it could be, even from my perspective, 3-4 dates in. You know, especially, as he said, if you know in your community and in your social world, dating is going to be a brief process, you know, and that you're sort of working under that, you know, premise that the majority of the work is done after marriage. Now, I come from a very secular environment, so it's a little different in terms of, you know, what the expectations are and the getting to know you are. Also, one thing I will point out is that you live in a sort of a very small community. and there's a lot of things that, you know, you might think are private that are not private, having nothing to do with the counseling center. Because I've seen that happen too, where this information has gotten disclosed without people knowing. And that is a very, very painful experience for everybody. So I think you really want to try and be mindful of the fact that you have something, you're doing something, and that it is in a sort of fairly decent fashion, you want to try and be honest with the person for both of your sakes. Because as they've both said, like, you're getting into a relationship and you have just as much to lose as they do. You know, you don't want to feel rejected when you start having some moment where you're not doing well in life and you're not competent, and you want someone who can support that. You know, you don't want to be with someone who can't support that. And why would you want to be, you know, false about that? That's what you're getting at, is can I be in a relationship? Of course. And the more honest you are with who you are and what you're going to need from your partner in the course, or imagine you'll need, because we never know what we're going to need, right? You could get into a car accident like the day after you get married. I mean, God forbid. But something bad can happen where you're expecting that this person is going to rely on you and need you and take care of you. You need to be as honest as you can about what your needs are going to be and move forward, because you will find everybody. I believe everybody, if they're honest and, you know, kind of find a peace with themselves, will find someone.
This is an interesting question. Are there certain personality traits that are not conducive to having a partner if you struggle with a mental illness? And are there certain responses or actions that indicate that my partner does have the ability or capacity to help me manage my illness? Are there certain responses which are red flags that they will not be able to help?
I can answer that a little bit. I do think, yes, there are certain things in people that are not, it would definitively not make you a good partner for somebody, you know, and I see that all the time. And I've said that to people that I treat, you know, somebody who has, you know, some sort of like, let's say that somebody has bipolar disorder and, you know, part of that can be like, you know, you don't want to be with someone who parties too much. You know, so if you're dating someone who's like a really, really wants to be out every Friday night drinking, even if they're not, you know, off the rails or anything like that, sometimes that's just not the best fit for you, you know, because these are triggers, you know, you can't really, you know, party as hard, stay up as late. You know, generally you'd want to, you know, have a more kind of stable life day to day, like not such an altered experience weekend to weekday kind of thing. I hesitate even mentioning something like bipolar because it's something that I will say also that this is the one issue with mental illness that's a problem is that there is such a fear and a stigma around it. So, you know, people hear bipolar and they get very panicky. And not all bipolar is created equally. Not all any of these things are created equally. You know, I have a dear friend who is a doctor. He has actually pretty straight up bipolar disorder. He is, you know, was diagnosed in college. He was off the rails, psychotic in a hospital, and, you know, got, you know, he didn't know what was happening to him. He was 21, I think, and you know, now he's 56 years old. He's been on medicine his whole life. Never had another episode. He's married. He has 3 children. He lives in Westchester. He's like, you know, does super well for himself. He's never had a problem. He's a lovely, lovely family that I see at synagogue. And no issues at all. So not everybody is created equally. And I think that if the minute somebody is divulging things to you or talking to you, I think the question then becomes, well, how did this get diagnosed? What is the problem? You know, like, how serious has it been in your life? Can I speak to your doctor? Is actually more important sometimes than speaking to your own parent. You know, can I ask your doctor what's gone on? Do you mind if I go in and find out, you know, what I can expect from, you know, your history, based on your history, what I should be able to expect from this? So those are ways to approach that.
Beautiful answer. I want to just add a point that the question is a bit troubling. To an extent, it presumes that we look at ourselves as having different components. I have myself, and I have my mental illness. So now, myself, I can deal with someone who can find me as a match, but I have this illness. I have depression or anxiety or some of the myriad, even if we don't get to bipolar, some of the myriad of things that are often hard to confuse, hard to know, is it a personality trait or a disorder? So I have that part. I have that part of me. Now, can I find that person? Can the person deal with that part of me? But in reality, the best way to look at mental illness is to integrate it as part of who I am. I have some sort of personality traits, you have some sort of personality traits. So just like on a shidduch, when you're trying to find if the person works for you, you're looking at the traits and see if the traits work. It's healthier to look at the person, look at yourself, and see if your traits mesh with that person's traits, whether it's on a resume or on a date. But to look at it as specifically as a bifurcated self, that there's the person and the mental illness, is not self. It's not serving in terms of the relationship. It's also not self-serving because you have to integrate as who you are, as opposed to a situation. So the question itself might be better if it was understood in a different context. That it's just who I am, not a part of a disjointed part of my life.
And I don't think there's really anything wrong with, you know, like if somebody does disclose these things to you, like I have depression or I have, you know, I mean, I think it's honest of you to say to yourself in a certain way, like, I don't know that I'm gonna be the best person for you. Like, I'm not that sensitive. You know, I'm not going to have an easy time with this. You know, I'm not going to be able to be, you know, like, have your back. I'm very independent. I'm very this. I'm very that. You know, that's part of kind of disclosing who you are and letting someone, you know, understand who you are. You know, again, like, some of these, like, anxiety and depression, they're so gray. You know, they're so gray in terms of what that means. Like I said, most people struggle with some degree of anxiety. It's actually a natural thing to feel, right? Sadness is natural. Depression, we don't think of as being like a natural emotion. Depression is more of a kind of a clinical term when we use it. Anxiety, however, everybody will feel in spurts, if nothing else, right, in situations. And again, like part of what you're looking always, I think, when you're thinking about people is how well do you handle your whatever this issue is, whatever this is going on for you, and do I see myself as someone who will be really thrown off if I have to deal with some of these moments with you? Or can I tolerate them? Can I tolerate that somebody's going to be depressed and I'm not going to want to go out tonight. I'm going to, this happens to me, I'm going to go spend a few days and kind of just chill out. I won't be around. Why don't you, see your friends this weekend? I'm feeling down. And sometimes it's really that can be clinical depression. Like I need a few days to sort of, it depends on what they need from you, what you think you're able to give. There's so many variables at every step of the way. So a lot of it is about communicating and telling somebody who you are and getting them to tell you who they are. And the sooner you get to that, the better.
If you're dating someone and he tells you that he has a mental illness, mm-hmm. but thinks that he's completely fine and refuses to get help because he doesn't see at all that there's an issue, if you've tried everything to get him into therapy, but he just doesn't think he needs it, what is the next step? Is it time to break up?
I mean, I would say yes, basically. I mean, I think if you're really seeing an issue in this person and they're not seeing it, if you're like, I see you as struggling right now and I'm not going to sit back while you don't take care of yourself, I think it's actually a healthy thing to do for you. I do. I think that you can... I think that it's the same thing as saying to stick with that is sort of to enable somebody to not take responsibility for themselves. That's how I see it. For their health on any level.
It's also hard to know. What does it mean? Part of the beauty of a relationship, mm-hmm. we live in a world that we have so many barriers to communication. We have phones, we have text messaging, we have Facebook. We have ways that on the one hand bring us close to others, but make us really very distant from others in terms of a real meaningful connection. Not that you can have a real meaningful connection long distance or through text or through Facebook, but it's a good way to trick ourselves into thinking that we do, but we really don't. And part of the beauty, the bedrock of a relationship from a religious standpoint and from a mental health standpoint is a real emotional intimacy that we can connect with another person that I feel that they understand me and I understand them. And so to an extent, likewise, hopefully, in a healthy relationship, and I don't mean just mental healthy, in a real relationship which is vibrant and which is exciting, there's going to be a certain level of understanding. If you really see there's a problem, and I see there's a problem, then if we're in a relationship, that means even if one of us doesn't, but the other one does, that's part of the truth and the partnership of a relationship. Mm-hmm. So hopefully the question doesn't exist, except in the world of academic theory. Pragmatically, it should be a situation where this person thinks you're suffering, this person thinks I'm not, but to work on it together as opposed to split it up. And if they can't, then the relationship is breaking up anyway, right, as opposed to being a relationship which there are two people in tandem who are really very much not linked.
I think that's it is sort of in this ideal sense that, at a certain point you come to a decision like that you're just not happy in the relationship, the relationship is going to end, but I do see it quite often, actually, this question in real life. I see it quite commonly where, people will come in and acknowledge, like, their partner is very depressed, not leaving the house, not doing things, not engaging, and the partner has said things like, there's nothing wrong with me, leave me alone, or, I'm fine, it's a tough time, there's a lot going on, blah, blah, blah. Is a really difficult place to be in, actually. So, it really is a place where you come to, you're going to, ultimately, I would tell that person that they're the ones who then need to go and speak to somebody to help them decide how to move forward or if there's any way to engage their partner appropriately. But I do see this happen, and, I do feel that it, with guidance always, it's like, I never like to see somebody make that decision completely on their own. But with guidance, if somebody is that rigid about their position that I'm fine, there's nothing wrong with me, even though sometimes it's painful, like you were saying, sometimes you've fallen in love and you love this person. And, and also you feel not pity, but some degree of guilt. Like, you know, I'm here. I told him I would love him through thick and thin. I told her I would love her. You know, I didn't, you know, it's hard to sort of say, God, I feel bad. Like, I'm leaving this person now. But I do think that there are times when that is completely appropriate because you do need to be taking care of yourself.
How can I be sure that my partner's behavior is an accurate display of where they are holding in his mental health?
How can I be sure what?
That, like, their behavior is, like, accurately portrays where they're actually holding in their mental illness, or in general. Like.
You're trusting them to tell you. You can't tell anything from looking. Mm-hmm. You're trusting the honesty in that. And if you're some way doubting or feeling like your own... Look, you're allowed to be worried. If you are with somebody and you're dating and you've both kind of fallen and they said, look, I have this, you know, and you at that point you're both feeling a little like, you know, I like you. Like, you know, sort of like you were both saying, like, at what point, but you were saying, like, you've seen the whole picture and you're like, I like you. You know, I really enjoy your company. I feel like you're the nicest person I've met so far and I love hanging out with you. And you're telling me this and I guess we could break up, but I kind of, you know, would like to sort of understand a little bit more about your illness because I don't meet somebody every day that I want to go out with. Then I think, you know, you gotta trust that you're gonna ask them, like, is this you? Is, like, what? How did this come about? What was the worst you've been? And then sometimes say, you know, like I said, can I go with you to your doctor? Can I find out, like, what this looks like or sounds like for you? What I can expect, you know, because it is a little scary for me and it's unknown. And you're allowed to have your fears. And I truly do believe that there are, you know, not everyone should be with a person who has any mental illness. There are causes to end a relationship and acknowledge who you are. Like, I'm not cut out for this. And that's okay. You're not a bad person, and they're not undeserving of a partner. But you're not a match in any terms, secular or religious, anyway. You're not a match. And, like, at some point, two people need to take responsibility for that and be like, I'm not the best person for you. I can't give you what you need, and I know that I won't get what I need from you, even though I think, you know, I like you a lot, we've got along really well. I think everybody needs to, at the end of the day, you need to respect your own needs, and you need to take care of yourself and appreciate that the life you want is something you can create with this other person. So that's what I would say about that.
Do you want to add a point, Rita? I want to add one point that, ideally, to an extent, part of the beauty of a relationship is that if you are in a situation where you're not sure if the person is being true to who they are, bring it to the relationship. Say, you know, how do I know this is you? Maybe this is just you on a date. Maybe this is not you with me, really. Before you get married, there is an upward slope from zero knowledge to real knowledge. Sometime along that line, you can express your hesitations to the person. It's unhealthy, and not from a halakhic, from a mental health, and from a relationship perspective. It's not healthy to have your hesitations checked at the door. Mm-hmm. On the date, you're the one who's asking, who's just being prim and proper, asking questions to everyone else. Ideally, if you say, you know, how do I know this is really you? What are you like on a good day? What are you like on a bad day? How do I really know this is you? Bring it up to the relationship. That can, number one, let you feel more comfortable. Number two, it can actually make the relationship stronger. So, to an extent, the supposition of the question is that there's this split. Ideally, the split, the gulf between two people is becoming smaller and smaller mm-hmm. as they enhance their general relationship.
What are some concerns to be aware of in a relationship where both partners struggle with a mental illness? What are some ways to navigate those issues, and what does that mean for their children? And then another question was, should I be concerned about my children getting mental illness when dating a person with a mental disorder? So I guess that's, like, what does it mean for our children when there's one person in the relationship with a mental disorder? What does it mean when there are two, I guess, like, genetically? And then just in a relationship standpoint, like, how would you what are some tips to navigate that in a relationship, I guess, to keep both partners in check?
Okay, so one thing that's interesting is this, you know, mental health in itself has changed a lot. We're much more out there as a presence in the world. You know, people are much more aware of us and conscious of, you know, kind of this notion is, it, you know, I'm feeling anxious all the time. I'm feeling, this is just, I've been sad for too long now, you know. And it's growing, okay. So what I will tell you is that a lot of the students who I've met over the years, interestingly, will say, I think my mother's depressed. I think my father's been depressed his whole life. I think my mother's ADD. I think my father is the most anxious person on the planet. I sit there and I'm like, you know, because one of the things I go through is like, do you have anybody in your family who's seen a psychiatrist, taken any medication, blah, blah. But there's such a stigma behind mental health that a lot of people never seek out mental health treatment. And are so fearful of this moment coming where they're going to have to, like, if I go to someone and I get put on a medication and then I have to go tell somebody else that I have mental illness, they're never going to want to marry me. My whole life is ruined. It's like, whoa. Okay, so a lot of our parents did not step up when they were struggling. And a lot of you guys do, probably because we are more present and, you know, you're more conscious of us, which we work very hard, Dr. Muscat there, to make happen, that we are available to help all the time, you know, and that this is nothing to be ashamed of. So, you know, that notion of where did you get your anxiety from, right, is like you got it from them. So, you know, are your kids going to get it from you? Yeah. Are you that poorly off? Are you that poorly off? No. And actually, the more you come to me, the more people generally were saying, I'm feeling better now, like, you know. And so at the end of the day, I don't think I can say more. I think you all got it by that chuckle. You're going to get things from your parents, period, whether they've acknowledged it or not. And then there are things that turn up that you never thought would turn up, because genetics is an odd, odd egg. It passes a lot of generations. It's, you know, you guys all know it. You get genetic testing a lot when you get married. These are not things we have tests for, you know. We don't have any tests for any of these things. You know, and I think that you just can't possibly know what's going to happen in the future. All you can do is sort of try and deal with the here and now as best you can and know yourself as best you can of what you think you're going to be capable of every day of your life. And when your kid needs you, because, like, I have a friend who's never – I thought she was the best mom in the whole world. Great wife, pretty loving relationship. Both of them never seen a mental health provider. Both of her kids are on medicine right now and struggling in certain ways. You know, they're in college. They're getting there and they're figuring it out. But, you know, you never know where this is going to come from. So just try and stay a little bit in the present. You know, we can worry about the future, but we need to kind of stay in the here and now and acknowledge who we are.
At the same time, this is the one issue of all the questions so far that you really need, Dr. Corey and Dr. Muscat. Meaning this is a situation where, not that you don't need them for every question, but here it's one of those don't try this at home situations. Mm-hmm. Meaning here, if you have two people that are unaware, as much as they've been educated with what we call psychoeducation their entire lives, they're aware of their own illness, and maybe they can do doodle searches from today till tomorrow about their partner's illness, to really know what happens when you combine the two is way beyond their pay grade. Mm-hmm. That's something which is important for them to speak to a professional about, to really Absolutely. Know what's going on. And even things they can evaluate themselves, that definitely is something they need advice about. You can have the reassuring answer of that before, but at least to do the shtadlus, do the effort to try to figure it out, is an important thing to speak to a professional about.
And I will tell you something else, that, like, so a depressed, you know, our studies really show very clearly that a depressed mom's going to, you know, potentially create a depressed child, not definitively or anything. But a depressed mom who got treatment, totally different ballgame. It's not necessarily all in the genetics. So a depressed mom who has come in and been like, you know, let's say you're dating someone, you're like, I struggle with depression, but I've been on Zola for, you know, 5 years, and so I don't have any problems. I haven't had a problem since I started the medicine. I've been doing well. You know, I'm pretty, you know, happy person. I'm going to start med school next year, and, you know, moving up with my friends up to the heights, blah, 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 right? So you're doing well. Like, that's a person who is very likely going to raise a very, like, well-adjusted child. So even if there's a genetic, like, predisposition, which, yes, there are actually numbers for all these things, which I'm not going to discuss now, but that is something that people come to me for all the time, to talk the numbers of what the expectations are. But the parent who's getting treatment is going to raise a child. First of all, they're not going to get any of the sort of depression from just the presence being around this mom, but also that they're going to learn how to take care of themselves, like if they struggle with depression, and they're going to learn to sort of feel like, there are those people who come to me and as like freshmen here or sophomores here and are like, you know, my mom's always had depression, she takes Zoloft, I feel like it's happening to me for the first time. Boom, they're on it. They come in, they're like, no problem. I'm like, all right, let's start this medicine, let's get this going. You already know what works for you, you know it's worked for your mom. You know, there's a lot of honesty in the family. Everyone's kind of comfortable, and they do really, really well. You know, it's not, it does not have to be a debilitating illness, mental illness at all. There are some debilitating illnesses in my world. You know, like schizophrenia clearly is a very debilitating illness. And, you know, in all honesty, I've been here 10 years. I don't know that I've seen, I've maybe seen one case of schizophrenia in the years I've been here. Yes, thank God. It's not very common. And, you know, usually if you guys are at this point, you're usually kind of past the big hump. You know, we're looking at the way people function and how honest they can be in life and then what you can tolerate.
What are some communication tips to keep your partner in check? Like, you know, even if there's one spouse with a mental illness or both spouses have a mental illness, like, what are, I guess, like certain things in communication or on day-to-day interactions that partners should do to keep each other in check?
I'm not sure what the question is exactly in terms of in check. But
I guess like
well, let's keep the question in check. Let's try to. So in general, that you know, this it's an overarching issue with relationships in general. One of the foremost researchers in relationships is a person named John Mordechai Gottman. Gottman was a person who started off at MIT. He started off focused on statistics and math, and eventually went into the world of family therapy. And he did a lot of rigorous testing to try to figure out what makes relationships work, what makes them succeed, what makes them not succeed. And he came up with his research is that, in general, he talks about bids for connection. Throughout a conversation, there are certain times that a person can interact with a person positively, and certain times you can interact negatively. And he found that in a relationship, if you have a ratio of 5 positive interactions to 1 negative, your relationship is succeeding. If it's around 3-2, 2-3, shove it to shove it, equal to equal, then you're in a situation where things aren't doing so well. But there's an amazing idea there, that you can have 5 positive to 1 negative. That means there's a lot of negative per day. It's just that there is overwhelmingly positive situations. Mm-hmm. So when we talk about keeping a partner in check to an extent, all of us need to be kept in check. We all have ups and downs. We have vicissitudes. We have ups, downs, and rights and lefts. We're not always the same person in the morning, evening, and the afternoon. Sometimes to accept the fact that our relationship always has a struggle and that we're always going to have differences, and the beauty is that we can have a rove, a strong majority of situations that's positive to negative to make a relationship work well, whether there's mental illness or general personality traits and quirks that we all have. Knowing that things are never going to be perfect, but there's a overwhelming majority can be very helpful in terms of knowing who we are and who our spouses are and are going to be throughout our lives.
If my partner is depressed and therefore shows disinterest in the relationship, what is the appropriate response, both internally and when speaking to my partner? And what can I do to help them? Is there a certain time limit when the disinterest makes him unfit to be in the relationship?
I mean, I think that's completely, again, comes back to this notion of knowing yourself and deciding for yourself, like, when you're done. You know, you're allowed to make that decision for yourself. Like, all you can do is encourage them, be like, I feel like you're depressed. I feel like, you know, you're not engaging with me. You know, either fix it, come talk to me, or I'm gonna end it. Those are my 3 options, right? And you know, depending on their level of commitment to you, you know, they're going to be like, okay, I'm going to go and this happens all the time. All right, I'm going to go and I'm going to talk to somebody, you know, because their partner really says, like, I can't live with this. You need to go and talk to someone. And if they're like, I don't want to, sometimes like, well, I'll go with you. Can we go together? Let's do this as a couple. And sometimes they'll agree to that. And then sometimes you're like, look, if you can't address this, I have come to a point where I cannot help you. I can't be the one responsible for this, like, low mood. I can't pull you from something. And I really want people to understand that it's not your job, like, as a partner in life to rescue in the most extreme. It's our job to support and help each other as partners, but not rescue them from something. You know, when they're ill, they need to get real help from, like, a professional.
And at the same time, that one of the mysteries of depression is that if a person has very little desire to do anything, how can they have a desire to seek help? Meaning mm-hmm. they don't want to help themselves because that's the whole problem.
Right.
So sometimes being a little bit mean, saying you better go, if you don't come with me to go to the doctor, I'm leaving, that's it. Mm-hmm. You think you're being mean. In reality, you're doing the one thing the person can't do, which is bring themselves to search for help. And that's an important thing to realize. What seems like being kind sometimes is being a villain and the same the other way around.
And I will say, like, the premise, is this the end of the questions? Are they done?
Yeah, I was going to actually, like...
I was just going to say really quickly, like, the premise of all these questions is understandable, right? All of them are based in some degree of worry, right? That you're missing something, that you're going to get involved with someone and you're not going to get it, and you're going to, like, what if they're sicker than I realize? What if I'm not up to the task, you know? And, you know, the notion that you are in some way anxious about those things, you have a responsibility to yourself to deal with that person about that. You should never be sitting, like you said, checking your anxiety at the door. That's never the answer. If you feel like I'm worried that I won't be able to be a good partner with you or be in a relationship with you, then you have to just say it. I'm worried that I'm not going to be able to be a sufficient partner. I'm worried that I'm going to let you down. I'm not going to be able to be satisfied here. Your worries are very relevant. Anxiety is the one thing in life that everybody has to some degree, and you really need to. I tell all of my patients in my life that I've been seeing, and I've seen thousands at this point, is that any emotion that we all have, whether it fall on the spectrum of an actual illness or just our regular range of emotions, that I use it as, like I say, you're taking your own temperature. Like, I feel an emotion. What does it mean? What do I have to do about it? Like, it's sort of taking a moment, taking stock of what you're feeling and moving on.
We have a few minutes left, so if anyone has a question that they'd like to ask.
I just want to make a point before we have a question. So it gives you more time to think, by the way, if you want to have a question. To an extent, in any relationship, there's what to be said for a gradual ascent to a relationship. You have two people that never met each other, or even if they did know each other, and they are now seriously trying to explore each other and create a relationship. What's interesting about relationships is that sometimes things that you talk about on the first date or second date become things you talk about on the 10th date. The very same things can have very different depths. On the first date, you might talk about what you did in the summers and talk about the two kids that were in your camp, let's say, that you were counselor for, some other things. Then all of a sudden, on the 8th date, you talk about how one of those kids really struck you, and there was a certain chord that struck within you, and you connect to that kid. Mm-hmm. There's a series of depth that keeps on going throughout a relationship. I sometimes think of it like an onion. It's almost Thursday night. Thursday night's already almost Shabbos time. People have Thursday night shalom, and then Friday night shalom, and Shabbos shalom, and Motzei Shabbos shalom, and shalom is specifically something which is ubiquitous. But one of the ingredients for shalom is an onion. If you take an onion and you just throw it into the shalom without cutting it, there's no real flavor. On the other hand, if you just cut it right in front of you without putting it under water, let's say, you're going to start crying. The same is true often in relationships. If you cut yourself as an onion and share your guts, then that's not a real relationship. You're going to cry because that's not real. The same thing is true if you keep yourself within the skin of the onion and you don't share yourself, then you're lying to yourself as well as the other person. It's true with all aspects of relationships. Mental illness, mental health, and religiosity, and personality, desires, likes, differences, and similarities, that you can have different levels of disclosing the same thing. And what's interesting about mental health is as well, you can sometimes talk about, if it's the time that Rabbi Weider was saying, it's already a situation that I need to disclose, you can talk about some of it and give yourself the room that I'm not talking about everything right now. It doesn't need to be, I'm dumping everything on you now. Talk a little bit about, you know, I've struggled with moods. I don't even feel comfortable talking about all that now, but I want you to know that it's something that I struggle with and I know about it myself, and I'm on top of it. Something like that. You're giving a little bit of an opening to discussing it and then letting it have room to sit with the other person, and then keep on discussing it in the future can be very real and very helpful, and it's very true to relationships in general. They need to develop gradually, so it's often wrong to yourself as well as the other person to just throw something out there. That's, again, not really truthful, and it goes within the flow of all relationships that grow naturally and organically and develop with a steady pace, as opposed to just needing to snap your fingers and throw things out about yourself or about illness that exists.
Yes, you can give things in gradations. I think that's a very well said. Like, you don't have to, you can just sort of acknowledge, like, yeah, this is something, you know, I'll probably want to talk to you about, but why don't we wait and see how things are going between us and what you think of me as a person, and I'm happy to kind of talk about this more as we move forward. You know, one of the things, you know, is, again, like, I've seen this from both sides, the discloser, the disclosee, you know, the sort of one who has it, the one who doesn't, and, you know, at the end of the day, both people can get hurt, you know what I mean? It's not just the one who's, like, gone to you and said, oh, I have mental illness, and they dumped me, and now I'm really pained. You know, the other person can people can get hurt on both ends, and you just really want to feel like, at the end of the day, I always tell people you have to remind yourself when they come to me and they feel sad about that outcome. I'm always like, you really want to be with someone. if it's the person who has a mental health, I'm like, you really want to be with someone who is not going to feel worried every day of their life around you, like that they're going to be on tiptoes or anxious or like incapable, oh my God, this is going to happen, I'm never going to deal with it. You don't want that. And the same thing goes for the person who doesn't. Like, you don't want to spend your life, if you are just too worried about this and can't like recognize in yourself, I don't know that I'd be able to handle if this person did this, then again, like, it's not a match. It doesn't mean that either one of you are like going to, you're both going to move forward and find relationships that satisfy, and you should always be looking for someone who wants to support you and be with you as an individual. So I would say that's the most important thing to recognize. And the sooner you're honest, the better. Like, so it's not like, again, like this notion of telling somebody on the first date, or I guess, you know, through the matchmaker.
Yeah.
you know, like that sort of level of disclosure can be a bit tough, you know, because they don't get, I think, which you've said so many times tonight, and I'm so glad to hear, that they don't get a chance to see the full picture of you, because, you know, it's a very, we are way more than just that one thing.
Like, if you're dating someone with a mental illness,
mm-hmm.
what kind of stage are you, like, looking in their mental illness? Are you kind of, like, looking for them to get, like, if they're still in it, like, kind of, like, burying it, or, like, if they're been doing crime for like a year, or, like, more, or, like, where is kind of, like, an acceptable point for, like, you to be dating them?
In an ideal world, it's when they are feeling fully managed. I feel well now. Like, that's the perfect place. Like, this is what's going on for me, and I am, but it's very well, like, I feel very well controlled, and it's been controlled for this amount of time. I mean, that's the time when you're going to feel most comfortable kind of looking at them and saying, okay, well, how often does it happen? Have, you know, since you've been in treatment, like, so if they went on treatment once, like this doctor I told you about, he went on treatment one time, literally at 22 years old, he never had another episode, you know? It's like, you know, when his wife met him, you know, 8 years later, and he's like, you know, I have to tell you, I have bipolar disorder. I was hospitalized when I was 22. You know, I became completely psychotic. I was in a hospital. I thought I was a king. And she was like, oh, you're kidding me. And he said, no, I just got to be, you know, I got to be honest. And he's like, you know, but that's, I barely remember it happening myself. That's what people tell me. It was so, like, I don't even really remember the time. And it's 8 years. I have a private practice. I function great. I'm working really, you know, I'm a hard worker. I have a lot of friends, you know. And she's like, okay, I think I can take the risk. She's like, I think I can take the risk. And it was a well worth it risk for them. They've been married for like 35 years and have a wonderful, wonderful, healthy family. I think you need to, again, like, acknowledge who you are and who they are, but ideally the person is in a state where they are well and can tell you what not well look like. Like, they can relate to you. This is what not well is. This is well. I'm well now. This is what I was not well, what this looked like, and why I started this journey of treatment for myself. So you know they're at their worst, and you kind of, in terms of the mental illness, not in terms of the person, but you know them at their worst, and you know them at their best in terms of their illness, which is an important thing to know. In terms of them as the person, you won't find that out for a few years. That takes a while. That full disclosure.
So much.
Did you have, go ahead. Sure, go ahead.
I know this is pretty circumstantial, but if you have a mental illness and you're dating someone with a mental illness, would you guys against that per se or for that? Is there anything you understand, or it's like?
Yeah, no, it can go either way. Exactly. Like, some two people who both have that can be the best support team for each other. Like, they get it, they understand it, they're sensitive to it, they're tolerant of it. It depends on the two individuals, what the underlying issues are, how well managed both of them. There's so many variables. But, like, and in terms of the genetics, the child, you know, the kind of, all of those things, there's so many variables involved. How well person does respond to treatment is a big variable. Some people can be like, this guy was super sick. You know, he's a really good example of someone who was really sick, because you don't get that kind of psychotic, you know, unless you have a full-fledged bipolar disorder. And, you know, it's like you need to sort of see, like, how he responded so well to treatment. He just, you know, never had, even on his medicine, never relapsed, nothing, you know, no, and he stayed on his medicine. He had no problem staying on it forever. He didn't care. He just took it like clockwork, went to his doctor every 6 months, got a blood test, and moved on. People with my, and sometimes it's a family. Like, I actually think his wife had a family member who had mental illness, so there was a part of her that felt like a certain degree of comfort with it. Like, you know, if as long as he's doing what he says he's going to do and he's in treatment and he always does well in treatment, you know, she was able to be a better support and feel more confident. That's what I'm saying about that worry. Like, she's like, you know, he can be fine. I know he can be fine. I've seen it. And again, like anybody who's worried or anxious, I always say go talk to their doctor. Like, either talk to your own person or go to, say, can I come to your doctor with you? You know, I have a ton of people who bring their spouses into my sessions all the time. I have patients who have brought their grandparents, their parents, their kids. They're just like, can you tell them what, you know, and I sit down, I'm like, you know, we just talk about it. What are you having, what part of this are you having trouble with, you know, to see if they can navigate it together. There's a lot of variability within mental health. It's just that there's a ton of stigma. People hear, you know, you're on medicine, and all of a sudden they're like, what does that mean? It's really not, you know, from my perspective anyway, because I prescribe it every day, a very dramatic thing, and it doesn't speak in any way to the severity of the situation. I put plenty of people on medicine who are not, you know, in any way not functioning, let's put it like that. So somebody could say to you, I take Zoloft, and it's like they've never missed a beat in their life. You know, they've never missed a day of school, they've never missed anything. They're just acknowledging that there's a certain amount of struggle.
I'm going to point something out, which, to an extent, it's figured out that it's at the end, because it's not technically a mental health illness, but it's a very, very prevalent situation. The issue is that one person dating finds out the other person is involved in pornographic use of the internet. It's a very, very common idea that exists in the Orthodox Jewish community. In fact, it's worthwhile for us to just talk about it so that we know that it exists altogether. And it is something which, to an extent, number one, it's very, very common, number one. Number two, it's very common to be bothered by. And it's important to understand that if you, whether you're a man or a woman, research shows that approximately one-third of users across the world of pornography on the internet are female, two-thirds are men. So it should apply to anyone in this room and people that they're going to be dating, whatever your gender is, to number one, to know that it exists, and number two, you can feel the initial reaction is to feel repulsed by it. Number three, to know that the situation varies from person to person. You're entitled to your feelings, to know that you can feel how you feel about it. You can discuss it with them, and discuss it with the person that you feel healthy consulting with, to know how to keep your feelings in check. It's something which can range. If the person is doing it casually, once in a while, they're interested in sexual exploration, that's one thing which is very different than if the person is doing it nightly or weekly. But number one, one of the major risk factors for why a person is involved in pornography themselves is usually a very low sense of self. So if you're critical of the person, you're actually going to be, on the one hand, defending yourself. On the other hand, that's exactly where they're struggling themselves. They're struggling with a low sense of self often. They need to numb themselves from it by using the internet, like any other things people use that are unhealthy, or substances people use. So to know it's a complex issue, which, number one, you're entitled to feel upset about and repulsed by. Number two, to know that it exists, and it's something which you have to grapple with. There is a woman that recently went to a certain rabbinic figure and said, you know, the guy I'm going out with is struggling with pornography. What do I do? He said, what do you want? This is today's age. Everyone has that. So that is wrong. That is wrong. That is not the response. That rabbinic figure was wrong. I don't know who it was, but I do know that he was wrong. Because that's it's a basic idea of validating the person's feelings. Yeah, you're struggling with this. You're right. For you, you find that this is not right. Can you work with the person? Is there enough positive to work with? Is it an overarching negativity? There are issues there, but to say, machavek, as they say in Yiddish, just to throw it away and say, come on, doesn't make any sense. Everyone's struggling with it. First of all, it's not true. Second of all, it's something which is important to realize that you're feeling that there's a whole web of discussion. My point is to open up as a discussion, not to by any means have a full presentation about it, but it's an important thing to keep in mind. It is very prevalent in today's day and age.
So much, Rabbi Peter.
Pleasure.
If there are any specific issues with with which anyone would like further guidance, Rabbi Maybrook and his wife, Dr. Maybrook, who unfortunately couldn't make it tonight, as well as the Counseling Center, are excellent resources. And also, YU Connect reached out to us and wanted us to let you know that they have experience with managing mental health and dating and have set up successful couples who struggle with these issues. Thank you so much, everyone, for joining us, and have a great night.
Bye.
Okay. If anyone has any questions, they'd rather ask me through my website. My website is therelationshipcouple.com. You're welcome to the website and fill it out. and it sent me an email. Nice to
meet you. You too. I thought that was wonderful. Thank you both. Yeah, it was really helpful. It was helpful for me.
Thank you. Lauren, you were awesome.
Okay?
Yes.
Thank you, sir.
I have okay.
Wait, I hope this was recording. Was it recording? Oh, an hour and a half.